This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 103 was recorded February 1st, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. We have a Macro Voices crude oil special doubleheader for you this week. Petroleum geologist Art Berman headlines, and as usual, Art sent us a fantastic slide deck that you're not going to want to miss. The download link is in your Research Roundup email, or if you're not yet registered, you can find registration and download instructions next to Art's photo on our homepage at macrovoices.com. But wait, there's more. After the feature interview, commercial oil broker Pat Hemsworth will be joining us in our post-game segment, so be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview with Art Berman.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 has now done a whooping 2% market correction off of the highs. And everyone is really interested in whether this is it, whether this is where the turn point is, or is this just a correction before this thing goes up again? What's your feeling?
Well, I don't know. I don't think anybody does. What I find most interesting is how freaked out people are getting. Let's put this in context. The market has sold off rather dramatically, so dramatically, in fact, that we are down to a level now which was, drumroll please, an all-time record high like 2 weeks ago, or less than 2 weeks ago. So it's really not the end of the world yet, folks. Now, of course, it's always possible that was it. That's the beginning of the end. But what we've seen now is a very small correction. It's not the end of the world. I don't see any reason to think that's over here, although, of course, it could be. Something that's interesting, Patrick, is some feedback I've gotten from listeners. I guess I haven't been as clear as I thought I was about how I see this market. Something I had said many times over the last year and a half or so was we're in a steady uptrend, and I didn't think that we had yet seen the transition from a steady uptrend to that parabolic rise that tends to mark the final stage of a bull market. If it wasn't already clear, I do think very much that for the last several months, we've been out of the steady rise phase and into the parabolic rise. So I think we're in those final stages. Now, the thing is, before you get ready to panic and say, okay, it's all over, in that transition, where you go out of a steady, we've broken through the price channels that existed on the S&P to the upside, and we're seeing that continued momentum to move to the upside, except for the last few days here. That usually, if you look at history, there's a pretty big move that happens in that parabolic rise, which I think may just be beginning. Doesn't mean it's a certainty. It's very, very difficult to time. If you think there's a rise to a blow-off top, you know, how far does it rise before the blow-off? The only guideline I know, Patrick, is it usually rises more than the sane people in the room thought was possible, and then all of a sudden, it's a sudden and dramatic reversal to the downside. I'll be very surprised if we're seeing the beginning of it now. I think more likely we're going to see this correction play its way out. We'll move on to still higher highs, probably more parabolic rise to come, and eventually we'll get that reversal. I doubt we're there, but who knows?
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar, because it looked like just a few days ago that we were potentially just going to get that bounce from an oversold state, but it didn't take long for that dollar index to just continue its distribution. How low does this go before we get some really oversold conditions that create a bounce?
Well, this is the thing, you know, it's really hard to call this one because in so many ways, I agree with what you just said, which is, hey, you know, looks like this thing really is headed south here. But I can't reconcile this with what's going on in Treasury yields, which we'll come back to in a few minutes. It doesn't make sense. If this was the dollar crashing and that's it and the bottom's about to fall out, I would expect gold and Treasury yields to be doing very different things than what they're doing. So I leave room for the possibility that we're seeing a bottoming process and it's about to reverse to the upside. Now, that's not what I'm seeing in the chart by any stretch of the imagination. It looks like the bottom is falling out of this thing, but I can't reconcile that with what I see happening in other markets. So I'm in hurry up and wait and see what happens mode.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil since we have a crude oil special this week. Obviously, you're going to have a lot to talk about with our guests, but what's your thinking here on crude?
Well, you know, finally, we saw this week a pullback in the market, as I've been predicting for weeks and weeks. Patrick, I think it's over already. I think we're headed back up to new all-time highs. We're not yet there at all-time highs, but I think we're headed in that direction. We saw a pullback that took us below the 13-day moving average, but just barely touched the 21-day moving average, and then we're rocketing ever higher. I'm going to save a lot of the crude oil discussion for our feature interview guest, so let's just cover inventory, and then we'll move on. API, the private data service this week, reported a 3.2 million barrel build on inventory. And that 3.2 million barrel build, after we've had a series of drawdowns in recent weeks, freaked everybody out, and the market took a nosedive, just selling off almost a dollar in a matter of minutes in reaction to API. Now, that's on a 3.2 million barrel build. The next day, Wednesday, when EIA, the official data, came out, it was more than double that size at 6.8 million barrels. But you know what? When the EIA data came out, there was a little move down. It didn't last. And very quickly, we saw the market starting to correct to the upside, and it just kept going. So what the heck is going on? Well, to be sure, gasoline is playing a big role in it. API had expected build on gasoline inventories of 2.7 million barrels. We actually got a drawdown of 2 million barrels on gasoline. That sent the RBOB gasoline contract just to the moon in a matter of seconds. But the thing is, Patrick, as much as you can say, okay, well, gasoline was a drawdown when API had expected a build, yeah, but you know what? API had expected a 4.1 million barrel drawdown in distillate inventories. EIA only reported 1.9, like, you know, less than half as much. So in the grand scheme of things, what we saw was a dramatic panic reaction to the downside on API. Then when we got what was really a much more bearish report from EIA, the official government report, the market had already been exhausted to the downside. It had no further down to go. It was looking for excuses to move higher, and that's what's been happening ever since. So we still haven't seen a meaningful pullback. Of course, there was a sell-off that occurred this week. I think it's already over by our time our listeners hear this recording. Given the couple hours it takes to edit this, we'll probably be back to a new cycle high.
All right, well, let's move on to gold here, because the correlation to the U.S. dollar is there, but there certainly doesn't seem to be any gusto behind gold whatsoever. What's your thinking here? Can we get up to 1,400, or is this where gold's going to start stalling out?
You know, I see technicians on Twitter talking about shorting gold here. And again, the thing is, it just doesn't jibe with what we're seeing in the dollar index. With the weakness in the dollar index, you'd expect gold to be taking off, and it's not. And if I look at what gold's doing, if I kind of look at, you know, two out of three, who wins between gold, treasury yields, and dollar index, gold and treasury yields, I can reconcile with each other. It kind of makes sense in terms of what's going on. Higher treasury yields, treasuries are the safe haven competitor to gold. Gold's not doing as well because treasuries are more attractive. That all makes sense. It comes together. Dollar index is the odd man out here. So that's the reason that I'm wondering if maybe we're going to surprise everybody and get a big bounce in the dollar. But yeah, gold is not breaking out. It looks to me like it's pretty tired here. And just looking at the chart, it appears ready to roll over. Now, that doesn't jibe with the fundamentals if you consider what the dollar index appears to be doing. So we're going to have to wait and see what happens. But right now, if I look at the chart, it's not nearly as bullish as you would expect given what's going on with the dollar.
Now, since you mentioned treasuries, let's move on there, because as I look on my screen here, we are almost at 2.8. Unbelievable. The yields are ripping higher, bonds taking the nosedive. It's almost getting parabolic here. I mean, is this getting close to the end game of this particular move in yields, or is there more to go here?
Well, it's definitely getting serious now, that's for sure. We're, you know, when we got to, okay, it's 2.6, it's 2.61. Is it going to make it to 2.64? That was the previous high. Okay, that's all behind us now. We're definitely moving higher in yields, lower in price when it comes to treasuries. And the thing that it really brings to my mind, Patrick, is, okay, big picture-wise, let's take a step back. How far could this really go? You can't go back to what we would think of as historically normal treasury yields, 5 or 6%, because the U.S. government would go broke. It couldn't possibly finance itself. So, you know, a lot of people have predicted the kind of muddle through Japan scenario where treasury yields stay low for a really long time. Well, they're sure trending a lot higher pretty darn quickly right now. Is this something that just goes to a certain, you know, point to a blow off and reverses? Or is there a structural change? And are we looking at that feared beginning of, you know, the bond market sell off? I think that junk bonds are definitely showing some weakness here. I think the junk bond short is coming back into view. And I'm going to be watching very carefully as far as where this trend goes from here.
Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Eric's interview with Art is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is everyone's favorite petroleum geologist, Art Berman. And Art, I've got to hand it to you, because the last time we had you on the program, back in October, you talked us through your comparative inventory model, and you said, hey, you know, if I look at where we are on the yield curve, it says to me that prices are headed higher, and furthermore, we're at an inflection point where they could head much higher pretty quickly here. And I remember being skeptical at the time, because I felt like, gee, you know, you've had a lot of success with this comparative inventory price model that you have, but I kind of felt like, gee, aren't we talking about apples to oranges? Because, you know, in the past, exports were not legal. Now that exports are legal, we're exporting a lot of oil. There's a lot of inventory drawdowns that are not coming from a change in consumption, but are just coming from exports. And I thought, does that really mean that the same model is valid or not? And when we discussed it at the time, you said to me, you said, hey, look, you're right. It's a different game now. But at the end of the day, inventory is drawn down. It's drawing down fast. And every time that's ever happened in history before, prices have gone up. And you said you were sticking to your guns. And that's exactly what's happened. So my hat's off to you there. My question, though, is here we are a few months later. We've seen this tremendous run-up in prices. Something that I've seen you tweet about quite a bit, as have several other people, is, hey, we've gotten to a positioning point now where there's like a 12-to-1 ratio of longs to shorts, and we've got more record net length in petroleum products, be it WTI and Brent and so forth. I mean, this is just ripe if prices do start to go down. Everybody's on one side of the boat. So are you concerned about a significant downside correction at this point because of the positioning? Or do you think that we've got further to go higher in oil prices?
Eric, that's an awfully good question. And if I fully knew the answer, I'd say so. I'm concerned about that too. But as with many things that we've seen in this market since prices collapsed 3 years ago, the rules are different this time. And when we've seen the long positions so outnumber the shorts in the past couple of years, it always leads to a correction. And I think the reason for that is that those were periods of sentiment-based excursion from the yield curve. And I recognize that as such. Mike Bodell, who developed this approach, recognized it as such. And so the correction was back to what the fundamentals suggested. And again, don't get me wrong. I'm not one of these, you know, total technical geeks who thinks that fundamentals rule the market. They don't. It's a speculative market. But eventually things have to, you know, regress to the norm based on fundamentals, and it can go on for a while. So what the fundamentals tell me, Eric, is that we are increasing price for completely rational reasons, as opposed to the excursions right at, you know, early 2017 when it was expectation of OPEC cuts, or in early 2015 when it was expectation that, you know, happy days are here again and the oil price collapse wasn't real. And so, you know, we're looking at a very strong and lengthy trend that's been going on since February, almost a year now. And until I see enough data points that say we're flattening or heading, you know, the other direction, I'm saying this is the trend we're on. So I think prices will increase. I don't know how much, but we're awfully near the five-year average. And my model tells me we ought to be somewhere between $70 and $75 when we reduce comparative inventory another 10 million barrels.
Now, just for our newer listeners who may not be familiar with your model, you work on comparative inventory, where a lot of people watch the EIA's inventory reports every week. You correct that to essentially the five-year running average of what, basically adjusting it for seasonality. What has inventory done this particular week of the year over the last 5 years, and how does this week's inventory report compare to that? So you're looking at it on a seasonally adjusted basis. Give us a quick overview of where we stand in comparative inventory, because it sounds like we're almost back down to the long-term average in terms of where inventory levels stand.
Well, that's exactly right. You've described the methodology perfectly. We were at a point a year ago, mid-February, almost a year ago, where we had something like 213 million barrels of excess. And just for people who are not familiar, this is a basket of crude oil and refined products. It doesn't include all refined products, but it includes the big ones like gasoline and distillate that I believe are most influential to pricing. And so we went from something like 213 million barrels. We got down to 8 million last week. We went up what I consider to be a relatively insignificant, not quite 2 million this week. And so we're effectively at the five-year average, which I hate to say it maybe, but I mean, that's what OPEC Plus were trying to do all along. And, you know, I guess my hat's off to them. One way or another, they've gotten us there. Do they deserve all the credit? Maybe not. Certainly a stronger economy has played a big role in not just U.S., but global consumption, and that's a big piece of it. But you could argue lower oil prices for several years running do have that effect, and I believe that was also part of OPEC's strategy, if in fact a strategy ever existed, and I'm not really sure that that's the case either. But since we're dealing in speculatives, that's my sense. So the five-year average, we're almost there. The model that I have, it's an empirical model, really, and it says that the price is about right. And unless that trend of comparative inventory reduction reverses, it's going to keep going up. That's just all there is to it. It's kind of that simple.
Art, you sent us a fantastic deck of slides and charts that I'd like to go ahead and get into. Our registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just look for the instructions for getting the download next to Art's picture on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Going to slide 2 in the slide deck here, it looks like you're basically showing us both the price history as well as what's going on with the forward curves. Walk us through this slide. What's going on here?
So if we look at the slide, I've got two kind of light blue lines there, and it goes through the history of OPEC getting proactive, beginning back really in late August, September of 2016, when they first floated the idea of a production cut as opposed to a freeze, which they'd talked about for much of that year. And of course, then they actually did institute the cut in November of 16. They extended the cut in June of 17. And so you put a line through all those, and that's $43 a barrel, more or less, WTI. And you look at where we are right now, or where we were a day or two ago when I made this chart, and we were at about 66. That's $23. So do I want to attribute all of that 23 or so dollar per barrel rise to OPEC? Yeah, I kind of do. it's got to do with taking an awful lot of oil off the market. And there's a slide that we can discuss that in more detail later on. But remember what the intent was of these cuts. The intent was to get inventory back to the five-year average. And the way you do that is to force the forward curve from contango, where you know, the future price is greater than the spot price into backwardation, where the spot price is greater than the future price, so that there's incentive to move oil out of storage. And the graph on the right shows kind of a monthly progression from September through January. And we see September was clearly a contango term structure. October was kind of, well, I'm not sure what it was. It was, you know, maybe very, very slightly backwardation. By the time we got to November, December, January, unquestionable backwardation. So, you know, the forward curve, it's a speculative market, and that's what tells producers or tells people that are paying for storage space that it's dumb to keep your oil, pay your carrying costs, get it out of there. And if there's a market, then all the better. So that's what those two slides are about. So OPEC, you know, has accomplished what they hoped to accomplish, and they effectively did it through this change in term structure of the forward curves.
Now, some people have speculated that OPEC has been intentionally trying to manipulate and shape the forward curve with the goal of making it more difficult for U.S. Shale producers to hedge their forward production. Because, of course, although they're making their deals with an investment bank, somebody has to, in turn, go and sell futures a couple of years out in the curve. And, of course, if the prices are depressed 2 years out in the curve, it's that much harder for the U.S. shale guy to hedge their production. Do you think that that's part of the motivation here, or do you think this is just a natural reflection of the market expecting tightening supply, which is what normally leads to backwardation in the term structure?
It's a complicated question to answer because obviously I don't know what OPEC's strategy is. Nobody knows what OPEC's strategy is, and there may be some truth to it, Eric. But you know, I've contended all along that the narrative about a price war between Saudi Arabia and some of their OPEC members versus U.S. shale is largely, it's an American invention. It's a hubris-based model that says, you know, we're so great that they're waging war on us. I think the truth is probably they chose not to control prices back in late 2014 because they didn't want to repeat the mistake they felt they'd made back in 1982, which was to take a tremendous amount of oil off the market, lose a huge amount of revenue, and not influence prices at all. So, I think that the OPEC oil minister at the time pretty much said, man, I'm never making that mistake again. Of course, he wasn't actually the minister who made the mistake. So, yeah, there may be an element of that, but I think it's much more of a profit motive on their part that if we can turn this thing around by withholding a relatively small amount of production for a relatively short amount of time, we're money ahead. The other point of argument, I suppose, is Rystad Energy just published a chart yesterday or this week anyway, showing the hedged positions of, you know, all the major U.S. shale players. And of course, they go from completely unhedged, some of the majors, Anadarko, not a major, but a big company, to Pioneer that's, I don't remember the percentage, but it's at least 75% hedged. So whether or not that's really part of their strategy, I don't know. If so, you know, good for them for recognizing it. But I think the fundamental point you made that they are trying to manipulate the forward curve, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Moving on to page 3, you're showing us essentially the effects of OPEC production cuts, taking 600 million barrels out of the global market. Walk us through this slide. Tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, so all I did was to go back to November 2016, which was when the production cuts were announced, and I just started adding up the cumulative barrels to show the, we know that they had a target of something like 1.8 million barrels a day, but I didn't really worry too much about that, and I just took country by country and added them up. You know, what did they actually produce relative to that November 2016 baseline, and that's what the chart shows. And as it turns out, they didn't meet their 1.8 objective. The average was 1.5, but you know, good enough. But it, as you sum those numbers all the way along, you end up with a net of 596 million barrels of liquids taken off the market. And anyone who doesn't think that's pretty significant, I guess, you know, we need to talk about that. And so following off of your previous question about how much of a threat to Saudi Arabia / OPEC plus is tight oil, I've done the same exercise for how much oil has these tight oil plays added over the same time period. And it's a significant volume. It's almost 160 million barrels. But, you know, compared to 600 million, it's, I wouldn't say it's an insignificant volume, but it pales. And so to me, that's why the price war argument is, or narrative is a little bit specious. That turns out, at least so far, that the volumes are between OPEC and U.S. tight oil are just not yet comparable. So it's really kind of that simple.
Well, you make an excellent point that those are very different numbers. But I just want to come back in terms of the trend that's developing here. Now, what we have seen in recent months is we know for a fact that there has been a whole lot of hedging, because you've seen that in terms of the swap dealers' net short positions and the commitment of traders reports. Now, it's true that some of that hedging may have occurred just to refinance existing debt, and we don't know how much of the hedging occurred for that reason. But if you look at history, it generally teaches us that there's a lag of 3 to 4 months between the price of WTI and the rig count really turning up to indicate a bunch of new drilling activity. And by those metrics, right around the time that you told us very accurately that prices were about to really take off back in October, which is exactly what they did, it's right about now that that should translate into a bunch of new drilling activity. And of course, as you have said many times, rigs don't produce oil, oil wells do. So we've got to get not just drilling activity, but fracking and completion of those wells. At some point, it seems to me that there ought to be a whole bunch of new U.S. shale production coming online. But boy, it's not spooking the market in terms of price at all. Nobody seems to be afraid of, oh my gosh, you know, what happens in 2018 once more U.S. production comes online? And we're already seeing big increases in U.S. production, almost 10 million barrels a day, on par with Saudi Arabia in terms of how much oil we're producing, and it's set to be more. So am I missing something here? Is it not really set to be as much more as I think? Or is it just that OPEC has a bigger hammer and their numbers are so much bigger that even, you know, I suppose even if there's 157 million barrels here, if that number were doubled, it still is a small proportion of OPEC's number. So if I look at what's coming in 2018, I believe, although obviously 2017, we've seen big drawdowns in inventory, I think that EIA has forecast that that would turn around to a surplus in 2018. Do you agree with that? And how much more oil do you think is coming as a result of the drilling that's starting to pick up now?
Well, you've gotten right to the core of the question and the problem, Eric. If we go to slide four, what we see there are two graphs, and I won't bother with the first one because that really just sort of addresses this notion of, you know, is there a war? But the one on the right, I think, is worth looking at. And what it shows is, on a tight oil play-by-play basis, this is incremental production since April 2015, which was the previous peak in U.S. tight oil production. And what we see there, just simplistically, is that the Permian Basin is the only play that's really expanded in a meaningful way. The Eagle Ford has pretty much petered out. Bakken has more or less returned to where it was, and the Woodford and the Niobrara they're not really a big part of the story. So as many people clearly understand, it's really all about the Permian. So, you know, looking at the numbers, we're ahead of where we were for tight oil production in 2015, but, you know, not hugely ahead. The real story is in slide number five. And slide number five addresses, you've mentioned one of my favorite axioms, which is that rigs don't produce oil, wells do. And the other axiom I'll introduce is that not all oil is equal. And of course, EIA and IEA, they know that, but that's not really included in their forecast. So, you know, they're smart people, so I don't want to take that away from them. But they seem to lose track of the fact that not all oil is equally refinable, equally valuable, and therefore adds equally to the market. So if we look at the graph on the left, what I've done there is to divide U.S. conventional production by API gravity, which is just how light or how heavy the oil is. The lower the number, the heavier. The higher the number, the lighter. And the important thing for everyone to understand is that the average input to U.S. refineries is about 32 API gravity, which is in that cyan blue color, of which there is a fair amount in the conventional part of U.S. production. And without a magnifying glass, you're not going to be able to find it in the unconventional or the tight oil portion. So what that says is that most of the oil that comes from the Permian Basin and the Eagle Ford and the Bakken and all of that is not refinery ready. You can't just stick it into a refinery and manufacture gasoline and diesel and all that other kind of stuff out of it. And that's a real problem, okay, because the world, their refineries are designed just like ours. So you either have to send it to some very specialized refineries, of which there are some, you know, in China and Latin America. Their volume is constrained, and you have to compete with other light oil to get in, which means discounting. Or you have to blend it with a lot of heavy oil. The graph on the right breaks down the various Eagle Ford, Permian, Bakken, the main sources of tight oil, sort of the type section or average tight oil, and then conventional. And you see the problem real clearly. And that is that there's almost no refinery-ready oil from the tight oil plays. And so what that says is you can produce as much as you want of this stuff. And let's forget it for the moment about the lack of availability of frac crews and completion and the things that you talked about. Let's assume, you know, you could just readily turn a well into supply. You still don't have refineries that are capable of turning it into a commercial product, and that's a huge problem. So the numbers are on the graph, but only 2% of U.S. tight oil is refinery ready. 12% is what we call light, which is the little bit of tweaking, blending, you can pretty quickly get into a refinery, and 85% of it is ultra light. Okay, what does that mean? Forgetting about the technicalities. What that means is that even if you can refine it somehow, it makes crappy gasoline, low octane gasoline that has to be put through some other process to add octane to make it commercially sellable, okay? The other thing that's even bigger hit against it is that it contains no middle distillates. And forget the technicalities of that. What that means, you can't make diesel out of it, okay? So it's not good for gasoline, although you can fix it at a cost, and it's no good for diesel. Well, those are the two biggest commercial products that crude oil produces. So here's the problem, and nobody, as far as I can tell, I won't say nobody, but certainly almost nobody at EIA or IEA is addressing this problem. You produce all of it you want. You can't use a bunch of it. That is a huge problem.
Art, I want to back up for just a second to the economics of these different shale plays. Now, the way that I understand this, and you can tell me if I've got it wrong, you know, the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, the Permian, they were all going like gangbusters up through the middle of 2014. When we had the big oil price sell-off, as I understand it, what happened is the Permian was the one where it was still economic to drill new shale wells, even at $40, $50, $35 oil. There were still economic plays in the Permian, but at those prices, the Bakken and the Eagle Ford and the other plays were no longer economic. Now, if that's the logic, it seems to me, as we go back up to $75, $80 oil prices, does that mean suddenly that the Bakken and the Eagle Ford get ramped back up to their former glory? Or are those plays played out for some other technical reason?
Right. So the issues are many, but let's talk first of all just about price. There are substantial areas in the core of the Eagle Ford, the Bakken, and the Permian that make perfect economic sense at somewhere between $40 and $50 per barrel, depending on, you know, the operator and et cetera. So there is no problem, particularly, or huge distinction based on just break-even price. Okay, now break-even price doesn't mean you're making any money, and that's a real problem if you're an investor. But we'll leave that aside for the moment. What is most interesting is that the Bakken and the Eagle Ford are more mature plays. We've been drilling wells in these tight oil objectives for many, many years, whereas the Permian, even though it's an old, mature basin, most of the objectives, certainly the Bone Spring and the Wolfcamp, to a lesser extent, the Spraberry possibly, these are, you know, relatively new plays. So there's more core locations left to drill that have not already been drilled. And certainly over the last 3 years of low oil prices, if it is a problem, the Bakken and the Eagle Ford drilling has absolutely collapsed to the very best location. And so at this point, I think, you know, they're pretty nearly, if not almost altogether, exhausted in terms of additional commercial locations. Maybe I'm overstating that. But so the Permian is advantageous, or is viewed more positively than the two older plays. Number one, because it has more virgin locations, more undrained, unswept locations left to drill because it's a less mature play. And the other thing is just a simple matter of economics, that people think that EUR, estimated ultimate recovery, is the key to you know, to economics. And it's certainly important, but it turns out, interestingly, that production rate is actually the most important sensitivity. And so the Permian has very high initial rates. What that means is, on a net present value basis, you get your money back faster. The Bakken is probably, well, it is, of the three plays, at the low end. It probably has the best EURs, but it takes a long time to, you know, to get your money back, because the rates are relatively low and the Eagle Ford is somewhere in between. So you roll all that together, and those are the main reasons that the Permian is better. But there are plenty of areas in all three plays that should make money at relatively low oil prices. So if that's not enough, then let's add to it the fact that the cost of oil field services have started going up again. One of the reasons that you could make money at $40 or $45 was because the cost of drilling rigs and completions and fracs and all of that had gone down like 40 or 50% from the peak, you know, the boom days that you talk about in mid-2014. So if your costs are lower, your break-even price is also lower. The other thing that's important to understand is, I can show you maps that I've made and I believe that say company X ought to be able to break even at $45. And yet I go and look at their, you know, their income statements and their balance sheets, and they're spending more money than they're making. So what's the deal? They're not making money, is the simple truth, at least the way I define it, which is capital expenditures divided by cash flow from operations. Other people might define it differently, but to me, that's the bottom line. And the reason for that is that these companies have a lot of other expenses. You know, they're in debt, they got interest expense, they got overhead, they got all kinds of stuff. But most importantly, it's all these damn DUCs. Okay, you drill a well and you don't produce it, you don't complete it, and you don't have any revenue from it. And that is an absolute no-no, to put it mildly, from a net present value standpoint. You go out and you spend $2 or $3 million to drill a well, and then you postpone any earnings for 3 or 4 years. Ouch. How can you ever get out of that deal? Well, I don't want to go into that, but we talk about these DUCs as if they're kind of a cool thing. They're not cool. They're a very uncool thing from an economic standpoint. So I look at, on the one hand, These guys ought to be making money. On the other hand, I go and look at their 10-Qs and their 10-Ks, their SEC filings, their income tax statements, if you will, and they're not making money. Not all of them, but most are not, and those are the reasons why.
And just for the benefit of any of our listeners who may not be initiated, we're not talking about quack quack ducks, but drilled but uncompleted wells, DUCs, is what you mean when you say duck, just to make sure that we're clear. Let's move on now to another subject that I think you and I very much agree on, which is, boy, the legalization of export of crude oil out of the United States has changed the game considerably. Moving on to slide 6, what are we looking at here?
Well, we're looking at the difference between the price of international oil or Brent and WTI or the Brent-WTI spread and the weekly crude oil exports that are now legal from the United States. And what we see pretty clearly there is that the increase from about, you know, 800,000 or 900,000 barrels a day clear up to 2 million barrels a day of exports, it coincides perfectly with the widening of that Brent-WTI spread. And the reasons are very simple. It's an arbitrage issue that, you know, if I can get, and it shows there that the maximum was $7.24, if I can get $5 or $6 even more by selling the oil internationally than I can domestically, then I can afford to discount my price by a couple of dollars so that foreign customers have incentive to buy my oil as opposed to what amounts to higher price oil from someone else. And I'm still making more money than if I sold it here in the United States. So that arbitrage has been key. Now, this graph is a week old, and that Brent-WTI spread has plummeted in the last week, and it's gone down to about $2.50 or $2.75 just this week, actually.
What do you think is behind that?
Boy, I wish I knew. I've analyzed it, and one theory that is certainly partly true is that a new pipeline called the Diamond Pipeline is now bringing Bakken crude directly to a big refinery in Tennessee, bypassing Cushing altogether and displacing light oil from South Louisiana and tight oil from Texas, which is now kind of stranded. So that's one theory, and I think it's part of the reason. But we have gone through, I believe, a brief period of structural price adjustment. Getting back to your question about the, you know, how the long boat is, long positions are a little bit overfilled, and yet today we had an increase in comparative inventory and a pretty big build in crude oil, and prices, the market didn't seem to care all that much. So are we done with that? Who knows? But, you know, so the point is that I don't fully know the answer, but what's basically happened over the last week is that Brent has gone down almost $3. LLS, Louisiana Light crude, has gone down about $1.50, and WTI is about flat. So for whatever reason, the spread has narrowed, and we really need to see what happens at the export market. But that's probably a negative for ongoing high volumes of U.S. crude oil export, but we'll see.
We've got Pat Hemsworth coming on after you, and she has a lot of hands-on exposure to those markets. So we'll look forward to getting her perspective as well on that subject. Moving on to slide 7, you're pointing out here that exports have been the primary reason behind U.S. inventory reductions. That makes me wonder, for whatever the reason, hopefully Pat will have some perspective on it, we are seeing a tightening of the Brent-WTI spread. We are seeing, therefore, that arbitrage incentive for a lot of U.S. export is declining. Do you think that that will change the trend in U.S. inventory reduction and potentially change the trajectory of this price rally that we're seeing?
It could change the export of crude oil. To me, that's the vulnerability, and that's not a trivial issue. As the graph on the right on, I think we're actually on slide 8 here, is showing that on average, 2017 saw an increase of something like 3.8, almost 4 million barrels a week coming just from crude oil exports. Okay, so if that arbitrage is less beneficial, then we might expect to see that go down. The argument on the other side is that there's a high level of interest in securing diverse sources. Remember that an awful lot of this crude oil export is now going to China. It used to be Canada was our number one, but just about our only export destination. Now we're sending more oil to China and East Asia in general and Latin America than we are to Canada. Canada is still a big player on exports. So we know that the Asians they've got an eye towards strategic concerns, not just necessarily bottom line. But the larger answer is that it's the graph on the left, it's the export of refined products that to me is really the kind of the steady upward movement that's drawing down inventories. It's the export of gasoline and diesel. Diesel number one, gasoline number two, that is really sustaining, you know, the whole export drive. So it wouldn't surprise me if crude oil exports down to maybe, you know, averaged out at maybe 1 million barrels a day as opposed to, you know, the 1.2 or 2.7 year over year that we've seen. But and that will slow inventory reduction. But again, remember, we're at the 5-year average. So we don't have to keep, you know, this heavy duty reduction going on to maintain high prices or higher prices or even have them go up. For right now, I think the world's appetite for U.S. refined products continues to grow, and I don't see any end in sight unless the entire global economy goes south, and that's always a possibility that we have to keep in mind. So overall, the answer is we want to look very carefully at whether crude exports decline if this Brent WTI spread continues to stay narrow. But I'm going to be looking more to make sure that the refined product export remains strong.
Moving on to slide 9, the final slide, I see on the left here we have your famous yield curve, which really is the epitome of your pricing model that we've talked about in your past interviews. So I guess the question that comes to mind, you know, you've illustrated in a very compelling way here that we've really drawn back down to the 5-year average. But, you know, EIA as well as some analysts have anticipated that we'll go back to a supply surplus in 2018. Do you agree with those forecasts? And I guess what I'm really asking is, you know, does this trend continue where we keep drawing down and we get below the 5-year average? Or was this more a case of OPEC managed us back down to the 5-year average because that's where they wanted us and they're going to now, you know, manage their production in a way to keep us at that level? Where do you think we're going from here?
I don't know, to be honest, but since this is about my opinion, I'll tell you my opinion. And my opinion is that we were below the 5-year average through much of the boom days of late 2010 through mid 2014. There's nothing at all abnormal about being below the 5-year average. And if OPEC is in the business of making money, which I believe they are, then up to a certain point, higher prices benefit them. Now, they also have a keen eye towards demand destruction. There's some price at which people cut back on their use of petroleum, and that's not favorable to exporting countries. So they're going to watch that. But as I read the comments that came out of this recent OPEC meeting, what I heard was that they're not where they want to be. I heard Khalil Bali say that, you know, maybe inventory reduction to the 5-year average isn't going to be the metric that we want to use going forward. I'm not quite sure what he intends to use, and the other thing I heard him say was that we are in this with our partner Russia for the very long term, you know, years. Now, I don't necessarily believe everything that comes out of anybody's mouth, but that's what was said. Everything that was said led me to believe that they're not done yet. Now, whether they can hold their coalition together, I mean, that's a whole nother conversation. But at least notionally, I don't think they're done managing it. So what the yield curve shows and what I believe is really driving all of this is that we've talked before, and everybody I think who's listening is aware of the fact that there's been a huge level of underinvestment in exploration and a fair level of underinvestment in development over the last 3 years. That alone is going to cause a lot of upward pressure on prices. The situation in Venezuela, some people like to say, oh, well, you know, OPEC's not really managing it. They got lucky that Venezuelan production is cratering. Well, you know, okay, sure enough. But that's another situation that we're going to watch. But to me, the real issue is that the big picture, zooming out from, you know, what inventories do on a week-to-week basis, we're in trouble here. We're in trouble in that we have not spent enough money. We haven't invested enough in exploration and production. A lot of the build in U.S. production is offshore Gulf of Mexico. It's not all shale. People need to bear that in mind. I don't see the shale players getting their frac crew availability up to where they need it for some time yet. And then there's the issue of the crude oil quality. So the final slide we look at then on the right is just showing that, you know, the gasoline and distillate, which are the two cash cows of the whole U.S. petroleum machine, are at levels that, this is again comparative inventory, that they haven't been at since the beginning of this price collapse. So I have to look at all this in a relatively positive way. That doesn't mean that I don't have concerns, because I do, I always do, and I don't know the future, but I do know the trends, and the trend has been pretty relentless since mid-February 2017, and with a few hiccups here and there, it continues to move up that yield curve. So that's where I think we're going.
Finally, Art, I have one last question for you, which is, I know that you follow Pat Hemsworth on Twitter, as do I, and have a lot of respect for her work. We are fortunate enough to have her joining us after your interview. She will have listened to this. So my question to you is, what question do you have on your mind that I should ask Pat? Because obviously she's much closer to the physical markets than either you or I are.
Right, Eric, and you're correct that I pay close attention to everything Pat says and have tremendous respect for her and her opinion. So what I would like Pat to answer is the question that I said I didn't know the answer to, which is, why exactly has there been the sharp contraction in Brent/LLS Louisiana, light Louisiana oil and WTI just this week? Has it got to do with this diamond pipeline? Has it got to do with something structural that's going on in Europe? Is there, is there some kind of correction going on? That's what I would like to have Pat explain to me, and probably many of your listeners have the same curiosity. What's going on there, Pat?
Super. Well, Art, as we close, I want to encourage our listeners, anybody who's interested in oil markets and is not already subscribed to your free blog at artberman.com is crazy, because it's free and it's fantastic content. The charts and graphs that you post there are on the same level of quality as what you see in this week's presentation. What else can people do? Where can they follow your work for people who'd like to find out more about you? And give us a quick rundown on what you do at Labyrinth Consulting.
Sure. Well, the website is a great place to go. The website includes all my Twitter feeds. I'm on AE Berman 12. If you want to know what I'm thinking on a day-to-day or even hour-by-hour basis, that's the real current place. And you get to hear everybody who says, no, Art, you're completely wrong, and here's why. So it's kind of a real time. But what I do, Labyrinth Consulting Services, is mostly I consult on commodity price trends, supply demand trends, and a lot of my clients are investment funds, hedge funds, managed money, who are trying to understand the risk factors, basically, that go into their portfolio selection and their bets on crude oil and natural gas.
Well, Art, I can't thank you enough for another fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues, and we'll be joined by Pat Hemsworth, who is a commercial oil broker. So be sure to keep it tuned right here to macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Art. But before we get started, joining us now is Pat Hemsworth, a commercial broker in the energy markets. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Now, Eric, before we continue, many of our listeners don't know Pat's name or background. So please elaborate. Why did you want Pat to join us after Art's interview?
Well, you hit the nail on the head, Patrick. People don't know Pat's name, and that's actually exactly why they do want to know her. Pat is involved in the commercial end of this business. So let's say you're down in South America where they don't have a lot of refining capacity. You're a distributor. You want to buy 3 million gallons of unleaded gasoline and 2 million gallons of diesel and have it sent on a ship from the United States or from someplace else. That guy in South America is calling Pat. She puts the deal together. She charters the ship. She sends millions of gallons at a time. If you're an investment banker, you're working with producers and you have just done a bunch of hedging transactions and you want to lay off your risk, those guys can't trade in the futures market the way I do because they're doing thousands of transactions at a time. They need a broker who knows how to set up block trades and do off exchange trades and some of these more sophisticated transactions. Pat handles that kind of thing. Similarly, a lot of her clients are refineries. They're looking at buying for the sake of hedging. They want to lock in their prices for a whole bunch of crude oil that they're going to be refining into finished product next year. So she's very involved in the physical market and in a lot of commercial transactions. Well, what does that have to do with an investment show like Macro Voices? Well, Pat is exactly the person, if you're on the speculative side of trading the way I am, Pat is the person you want to know more than anybody else. Because when I talk about what hedgers are doing or what producers are doing in the hedging space, you know, I'm speculating. I'm looking at the commitment of traders reports. I'm trying to guess what these guys are up to. Pat's getting the phone calls every day from people that are actively putting deals together in the market. So she's got her finger on the pulse of the market much more directly than someone like myself. And that's why it's so valuable to me. It was actually when I spoke to Art and said that we had Pat coming on. The first thing he said is, I got questions for you to ask Pat. And I said, well, just give us one that we can put on the air, which of course he's already asked. And we'll come back to that in a minute. So Pat, it's great to have you. And we're really excited to continue our crude oil conversation.
Now, I wanted to get right into that because I really enjoyed that interview with Art. What was particularly interesting, actually, when we go back and listen to it, was his comments on the fact that not oil is the same. I mean, this is something we all knew all along, but it was interesting kind of him commenting on all the different grades of oil coming from the different shale fields and that not all of it is refiner ready, right?
Well, Patrick, it's like having a party and you've got a whole bunch of sour mix. If there's no tequila, then there's no margaritas, there's no party. And I think so many people don't get that about the market, that all of this tight oil that's being produced, you got to mix it with Canadian or Venezuelan. Of course, Venezuelan heavy oil is hard to find. There's got to be heavier oil from someplace to mix it with or it can't be refined. And most people just don't get that.
Absolutely. Now, Pat, you had a chance to listen to this interview in advance, and so we would love to hear what were your reactions were to Art's interview.
Well, I thought it was excellent, and he put his finger right on the issue. The U.S. tight oil that we're producing right now, largely out of the Permian Basin, is a very, very high API. Much of it is higher than 40, and I think some of it is as high as 50. And what does that mean? It means that it's really not appropriate for most U.S. refineries. In fact, most world refineries. We're processing heavier crudes somewhere around the 30, 32, 35, and so is the world. And so all of the crude that we're producing is really not quite ready, but it's presenting technical challenges for us and also for our new trading partners, particularly the Chinese, you know, as they try to figure out how they can blend our very light crudes with other existing crudes. So it's presenting a technical challenge. And while it looks like crude is crude, it's not crude. Crude is not all, you know, the same. And it's driving some spreads. And it's also driving what's going on in Cushing right now and the huge drawdowns that we're seeing in Cushing.
Pat, let's pick up on that point about Cushing that you just mentioned, because this is something that I know a lot of us have been a little bit confused by. There have been some builds recently, including this week, a pretty significant build in inventory. But even though they fixed the Keystone Pipeline after that spill, Cushing, Oklahoma has had massive drawdowns, even in weeks where there's been a nationwide build. What's going on in Cushing, Oklahoma, and why is it that that oil in Cushing seems to be being drawn down when everybody else is building?
Well, we've had drawdowns, I guess, for 13 weeks out of Cushing. The reality is that this light-heavy dichotomy and the need for heavier crudes, which are now we're getting less of because of the pipeline capacity from Canada is not as great as it could be. And the flows are reduced because of some problems that they had with leaks a couple of months ago. So there's less Canadian crude, less Canadian heavy crude, and the heavy crudes that the refineries need. And we're having less imports from Venezuela, which is all heavy crude. We're having less imports from Iraq and Saudi Arabia. All the heavier crudes are basically being deferred to Asia. So we have a lack of heavy crudes, and the heavier crudes are being stored. There's more heavy crude in the Cushing inventories, and so refiners and users, commercial users, are pulling that heavier crude out of Cushing. And so that's why we're seeing these big draws. There really is a kind of growing lack of heavier crude in the United States. So that's affecting Cushing. That's affecting the WTI spread. And there's other things affecting that, too.
Well, let me ask you where this is headed, because it seems to me like, you know, we're pumping as fast as they're allowed to. The Keystone Pipeline is back online. As I understand it, they're at about 80% of capacity, but it's not like they can turn the throttle up. They're going as fast as regulators will allow them to go in the wake of the spill that happened a couple of months ago. Now, if anything, there is a risk of Venezuelan output going dramatically down from here. I don't think Venezuela gets fixed anytime soon, from what I'm hearing out of there. And I'm not sure that there are other sources that are readily apparent of heavy oil that are going to increase coming into the United States. So are we in a situation where you could have builds occurring nationwide, but Cushing is at risk of, you know, running dry effectively if that's the only source in storage of heavier oil that can be used as blending stock?
Well, I don't know if we're going to run out, but this is the kind of thing that people are talking about right now in the physical markets. It's interesting because a Chinese national trading company decided to open up an office, announced it today in Houston. And what are they going to do? They are going to be taking Latin American crude and bringing it into the United States. And they're also going to be taking U.S. crude and selling it to different clients in Asia, including for their own use. So there's a need to create new trading flows to solve this problem. People are amazing in this industry, you know, for their creativity and resourcefulness. And that is a problem that people are actively working on right now. We'll see what happens. Certainly Venezuela is falling apart. It affects all trade in the Atlantic basin and also the world. But maybe that's another story.
Well, Pat, from what you just said, that really gives me some insight into what's going on with the time spreads over the next several months in the WTI market. We'll come back to that later on. But I want to ask you a question first about the producer hedging process, because a lot of people understand that producers hedging and selling their forward production in order to lock in financing to drill new wells is a very important part of understanding and trading these markets. But a lot of people don't understand the process. They think that producers directly sell futures contracts, and it doesn't really work that way. So please explain, when a producer wants to hedge their forward production, who do they make the deal with? What kind of deal is it? And what is the process then after that for if they're dealing with an investment banker? You know, what's the next step? And how does that eventually translate into futures being sold further out on the curve in the futures market?
Okay. All of these producers have bankers, bankers that provide finance for their drilling. Any bank who lends money to a producer does not want to be exposed to a drop in prices before the crude is out of the ground and marketed. So the banks provide hedging vehicles for the producers, and usually that is in the form of costless collars. And essentially what that is, you know, they would take a strip of, say, if we were to look at June to December, if they wanted to lock in their production prices for the second half of 2018, the bank could present to them a number of different ways of hedging. The most popular is costless collars. So that would involve selling a call above the market, which would lock in an upside to the market. And then they would buy a put, and the call, which they sold, would pay for the put underneath the market. So you have to think almost in terms of a band. So producers would be protected within a band of 45 to 65 or 70. The wider the band, the more expensive it would be. Then what happens is the banks are on the other side of that transaction. They're essentially long. So they need to lay off that risk on the derivative market. So most of these transactions are done OTC under ISDA agreements. Then the banks themselves manage that hedge. They are considered swap dealers. They can get in and out and dynamically, you know, manage their position. They're really quite sophisticated, and they're looking at options based trading as well.
So the producer is essentially buying a put option in order to protect themselves from a downside move in market prices. The way they pay for that put option is by selling a call option above the market. That means that they're limiting their upside if the market goes up, but it gives them the money to pay for the protection they have on the downside. That leaves the banker basically on the other side of those trades. They're laying it off in the futures market, and because those bankers are considered swap dealers, that's why we watch the swap dealer column in the Commitment of Traders reports.
Exactly. And they're in and out of the market. They're dynamic. And we talk about the speculative activity in the market and how that can potentially move the market in some kind of way. But certainly, if the market is rallying sharply and the banks have laid off their risk, we can watch their activity through, you know, the Commitment of Traders report and swap dealers' positions and how they change. We're also watching the forward curve, and that plus the Commitment of Traders gives us a clue to what they're doing. Another source of information is the government reports, which are filed by the producers themselves. They're required to disclose what their hedging programs are.
Pat, I want to move on to Art Berman's question, and I know the slide deck that you sent us is going to address this, because you've got something like 20 years of history on the WTI Brent spread on the graph that you sent us. And for our listeners, you can find the download link for Pat's slide deck, in addition to Art's slide deck, in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go and look next to Art Berman's picture at macrovoices.com, and you can find the registration and download instructions. So what the heck is going on with this WTI Brent spread?
Diamond Pipeline is definitely part of it. It just eliminates some of the bottlenecking, bringing actual crude out of Cushing. But as you remember, WTI is physically deliverable contract, and its delivery point is Cushing, Oklahoma. Also, you know, we have relatively high refinery runs right now, and those refinery runs, as mentioned by Art as well, those refinery runs are supported by very, very good demand at this moment. A little bit about South America. Right now, the Mexican refinery system is really unbelievably decrepit. Venezuela used to provide products in the Caribbean and to Mexico, and they're pretty much gone. And Brazil is also growing and importing tremendous amounts of diesel and gasoline. So refinery margins are decent, which means that they're running their refineries at pretty high capacity. They're using a lot of crude. That's part of the WTI story. The other part of the story is the fact that we are exporting more and more of this lighter crude that we can't use as well. You know, I think we averaged last year 1.6 million barrels a day. That is a pretty significant amount of exports. And then there is the Brent side. And Brent has its own unique dynamics. We just came out of a period where Brent shut down. 400,000 barrels a day was off the market for a couple of weeks around the holidays because there was a crack in the Forties pipeline. So, you know, something like that would really affect the Brent more than WTI because all of the North Sea is priced basis the, you know, the Brent. What else? Any kind of geopolitical chaos affects Brent much more because it's been used as a global benchmark. It's a whole other story, I mean, about how the spread evolved. Definitely Brent is much more sensitive to, say, disruptions in West Africa. Any kind of terrorist activity in Nigeria might immediately be reflected in Brent rather than WTI. Anytime that Brent goes through maintenance, prior to the end of the fall, we went through a maintenance period in the North Sea where a lot of production was operating at less than maximum capacity, and so that can affect the spread. But there's many factors now, and I think, you know, probably the most dramatic been the reduction of crude inventories at Cushing due to less capacity bringing crude oil out of Canada and also into the country through imports.
Now, Pat, I just wanted to ask about crack spreads. Now, I personally do a lot of trading in the actual energy companies, and often I've been trading these refiners, especially over the last year. They've been a hot place to be. And it's always interesting because they behave a lot different than the producers because they're not based on oil prices, but rather those crack spreads. And just curious if you could give us a little more insight into how these refiners hedge these crack spreads in the market.
Basically, a crack spread represents the margin that a refiner gets, and it's the differential between the crude that he buys and the products that he sells. So very often, the way these crack spreads are executed is that a refiner will buy crude oil and then lock in through the futures markets or the OTC markets, will lock in the price of their products by selling. So what happens at, say, at this time of year, as the winter ends and we start getting into early spring, end of February, March, the refiners go through what they call a maintenance period. And March kind of corresponds globally to a time of reduced demand for products. So it's a natural time to bring down some of the refineries to do repairs. Therefore, it's kind of a lower period of crude consumption. What will happen is that refiners, depending upon the level of the crack spreads and the profit margins, they can decide to either defer maintenance or to time maintenance, you know, based on performance of the futures markets.
Pat, I want to come back to that topic that came to my mind earlier when you were talking about Cushing being drawn down, which is intermonth spreads, or what some people call time spreads, the difference in price from one month to the next. What are some of the factors that affect them? And particularly, you know, we're seeing a widening of those spreads that wasn't there in the market 6 months ago. And there's a pretty significant backwardation spreads that exist now in the market. What's causing that?
Okay, let's say you were a merchant and you own crude oil and you're storing it in Cushing. If you're watching what's going on in the marketplace, you realize that there's increased demand for your oil. And so you may want to take it out of storage and to sell it. And so what will happen, your hedge, your short hedge really needs to be taken off. So you're a buyer in the market. It's sort of a natural thing as demand picks up for short sellers to have to cover their positions as they take the physical out of storage to sell it. So we're seeing that now. We're seeing the front end demand really pulling those spreads. And it starts with the front months are right now are very, very steady. You know, now March, April, I forget exactly where we settled, but we settled somewhere around 20 cents. So we are in a solid backwardation right now, and it's really driven to a large extent by the near-term demand for crude and crude out of Cushing, since the WTI contract is deliverable in Cushing.
Pat, I want to touch now on what's going on in the market, because I have been saying for weeks and weeks on this program, folks, get ready for a really big pullback, because there is such an incredible speculative long position. We're at an all-time record in terms of both WTI and Brent for the ratio of speculative longs to speculative shorts. We have an all-time high in commercial shorts, an all-time high in speculative longs. This is the perfect everybody on the one side of the boat scenario that you hear somebody like Jim Rogers talk about. And boy, you know, I keep saying when the going gets tough and the seas get heavy, if people start jumping ship, it could get ugly real fast. And what's happened, much to my chagrin, is I keep saying, okay, people, get ready for a really big pullback here, because you could see an unwind of these massive, massive speculative positioning. And what happens is we get a pullback, like I'm predicting, of all of a dollar or two, and then we're back up to the races. And as far as I can tell today, the pullback that we've seen over the last few days is over, and we're headed back towards new highs. What the heck is going on here?
I think that a large, long speculative position in and of itself isn't necessarily a danger sign. What I see in the market is a market which has been going up very, very slowly, very regularly, and relentlessly, but in a very orderly way. Implied volatility levels in the options had been ranging around 16 to 17% for a while. And now we're starting to slightly come up. This might be a very, very powerful bull market. We have a very strong fundamental story for why it is. But the large speculative position is part of a much, much larger market in general. We are now at record open interest. We're pushing 2.7 million contracts. Sellers as well. You know, we have a much bigger physical market, greater hedging. Every time one of those merchandisers in Cushing wants to buy back the short position that he's hedging, who sells it to him? It's a speculator who provides liquidity and who provides, you know, an ability for the commercial to get out. What I think is that we are moving into a period where we're probably going to see greater volatility as we move into the maintenance period. We're entering into it now. March is a time when demand for crude globally goes down. That will be a time when we'll really come to the test. We will get some liquidation, but it won't be because of speculators. It'll be just because we're going through some seasonal adjustments, you know, to consumption. But I think that we're going to make this bull market, but that we are in for a little bit more of a rockier road and possibly pullbacks coming into the turnaround period. So I'm not particularly worried about the speculative size of the positions, but I'm kind of concerned about this low volatility. It's like the calm before the storm. That's what it feels like to me.
You know, Pat, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, you've added a whole new perspective on top of Art's insights on the oil market. Now, before we let you go, I have to ask, I know your primary business is in the big commercial accounts, buying and selling all these entire cargoes and finished products and so forth. But for our more speculative investors who would like to work with a broker who has a background and knowledge like you in the market, are you open to taking on new clients who are more oriented toward investment? And if so, how can our listeners contact you?
On the slides that I have, I have all of my contact information, but the answer to your question is yes. I have some energy expertise, which could be of use to a professional investor or asset manager or portfolio manager. But our firm has some very sophisticated and excellent services for institutional investors, all of the administrative support that's necessary for their special needs. And so the answer is yes, our firm is a very good place for an institutional investor involved in energy trading. Thank you for asking that question.
Well, Pat, I cannot thank you enough for joining us and adding so much in addition to Art Berman's perspective on this very interesting oil market that we're looking at.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Listeners, we need your help as well. We're obviously out of time for today's show, but we need your help promoting Macro Voices. The more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests on the program. So please forward your research roundup emails, tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, and most importantly, if you haven't already, go to macrovoices.com, register your free account. We're not going to spam you or try to sell you anything. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email every week, which contains downloads to our slide decks, as well as all of the other free, interesting content that we were able to find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
All right. Well, you'll find the transcript for today's interview with Art. You'll also find the link to the chart books that accompanied both Art's and Pat's interviews. You'll also find an article from Bloomberg on Bridgewater tripling its bets against Italian firms, now up to $3 billion. There's also an article written by Jared Dillon titled that there won't be 3 rate hikes this year from the Fed. And so lots of really interesting things to read. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. So we appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. And for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates, and you can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.